Media are replete with stories of the next big bug. Books like The Stand and films like Contagion have relied on the fear of and fascination with deadly disease to draw audiences to them, while news outlets regularly feature stories about the latest strain of drug-resistant bacteria. Researching and tracking the next big bug is the focus of this episode of Stats and Stories, where we explore the statistics behind the stories and the stories behind the statistics. I'm Rosemary Pennington. Stats and Stories is a production of Miami University's Departments of Statistics and Media, Journalism, and Film, as well as the American Statistical Association. Joining me in the studio are our regular panelists, John Baylor, chair of Miami Statistics Department, and Richard Campbell, former chair of Media, Journalism, and Film. Our guest today is Scott Evans, professor of epidemiology and biostatistics at the Milken Institute School of Public Health at George Washington University. He's also the director of GW's Biostatistics Center. Among his research interests are the prevention of the public health threat of antibacterial resistance. Scott, thank you so much for being here today.
Well, thank you, Rosemary. Pleasure to be here.
Just to get us rolling, how did antibacterial resistant bugs become your research focus?
Well, when I first started my career, I was working in HIV, doing clinical trials, evaluating interventions to treat HIV. Mm-hmm. And as time went along, I saw a number of documentaries on television and so forth that were describing the rise of superbugs, superbug infections. I quickly became interested in it. And back in 2011, the NIH Clinical Center actually experienced an outbreak of a superbug infection that affected 18 patients. 11 of those patients died. And as a result, the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases initiated a new clinical research network called the Antibacterial Resistance Leadership Group. And I became a part of that group as I had some clinical colleagues that were sort of competing for this grant. And I joined that team, and we were fortunate enough to get that grant. And so we've been working on this superbug infection problem since 2013. And that's how I got started with it.
So just to take us back just one step, how do you define a superbug? How do you know how many there are, or what's the prevalence of this? I read in one of your papers you reported estimates of like 25% to 75% of antibiotic use being unwarranted in acute care hospitals. So, you know, how do we know such percentages, and what are these things?
Yeah. The general term superbug generally refers to a bacteria that has become resistant to antibiotics. Now, we've had antibiotic drugs around since the mid-1900s, mm-hmm. and the idea behind antibiotics is they are able to kill bacteria. Antibiotics are very, very powerful and important part of our sort of medical armament. Antibiotics really allow us to do many of the medical procedures that we do on a regular basis. You need antibiotics if you're going to do chemotherapy for cancer, if you're going to do dialysis mm-hmm. for renal failure, if you're going to have neonate care or intensive care unit care, and various surgeries such as organ transplantation. Anytime you do procedures like that, there's a risk of infection. And what antibiotics do is help us either treat or prevent those infections. So the problem with what happens, what we have with the antibiotic resistance is in many ways sort of a bacterial Darwinism, mm-hmm. that the bacteria that are resistant to antibiotics or develop a resistance to antibiotics, those are the bacteria that live to reproduce and spread. And so we're sort of constantly in a cycle of sort of bacterial Darwinism, and we come up with antibiotics that can fight those bacteria, but those bacteria are smart and eventually learn to become resistant to antibiotics. One of the challenges we're having right now is that although we have many, many antibiotics that have been approved by regulators for use for many, many years, those antibiotics are, because they're in common use and the bacteria are figuring out how to become resistant to them, what you really need is sort of a continual pipeline of antibiotics, new antibiotics that can fight these bacteria. And the pipeline for antibiotic development has slowed, and there are many reasons for that. Now, bacteria are several. There's several different types of bacteria. Some of the common ones you may have heard of, strep. Strep, which you may hear about, strep throat is a bacteria. Staph aureus is a staph infection, is a bacteria. Gonorrhea is a bacteria. But there are some very important bacteria that, in particular, have developed that are particularly difficult to treat with today's antibiotics. Things like Pseudomonas and Acinetobacter and CRE. And what happens is you can get an infection that is due to one of these bacteria, and those infections can occur in many different places in the body. You can get a lung infection, you can get a skin infection, you can get a urinary tract infection, an intestinal tract infection, and so forth. And the hope is that we can use antibiotics to treat those infections. But as resistance to these antibiotics develop, those types of infections become more and more difficult to treat. And so we're looking for new ways to or looking to develop, say, new antibiotics or new ideas to fight these bacteria that have become resistant. A couple of one particularly interesting new idea, and it's in the very early phases of sort of development, is antibiotics generally are a drug. They're a chemical compound that is made up by humans. We start to put chemicals together, and that's how we make antibiotics. But a new strategy that we're developing is there are sort of natural enemies of these bacteria, viruses and other things. And the idea is, can we actually use a virus, a naturally enemy of the bacteria, to kill the bacteria? Mm-hmm. And so we actually fight one infection, a bacterial infection, with another infection by introducing a virus that attacks and eats that bacteria. And there's been at least anecdotal evidence of some success with this strategy, but we need to study it a more systematic way. But there have been a few people who have developed very serious infections, which we've tried essentially all the antibiotics we have in order to treat those patients. They weren't able to respond to those in a positive way. And so we went to they tried these are called phages, bacterial phages, viruses that kill this bacteria. And so they tried phage therapy, and there's been a number of cases where people have recovered using that phage therapy.
Can you talk about a little bit about the scope of the problem? I think I heard in an interview, or maybe it was one of your articles, that this affects antibacterial resistance affects about 2 million people each year in the U.S., and that there are 23,000 deaths.
Yes, that's right.
And how are those numbers compiled? Where do we get those numbers? How do we know that?
So the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, back in 2013, released a report that stated that at least 2 million people acquire serious bacterial infections that are resistant to antibiotics that were designed to treat those infections, with about 23,000 dying as a result. Mm-hmm. That's in the United States. And now in the European Union, there's about 33,000. Some new data suggested about 33,000 people die from these infections annually. Now, the CDC is due to come out with a new report this year, which will update those numbers. Mm-hmm. And it'll be interesting to see how those numbers have evolved over the past 6 years or so. One of the big causes, as you mentioned earlier, one of the concerns we have is that there's a lot of sort of overuse or misuse of antibiotics, which only sort of adds to the problem. So a lot of times, if a patient comes into the emergency room with sort of flu-like symptoms, for example, and maybe they have the flu. Well, the flu is a virus. And antibiotics are meant to treat bacterial infections, mm-hmm. not viral infections. And so if antibiotics were prescribed to treat the flu, first of all, the antibiotics are unlikely to have any positive effects mm-hmm. of that. And they may even have some toxicities. And they potentially promote the development of resistance to these antibiotics. And so there's a concern that there's a lot of overprescribing of antibiotics that now part of that is that we don't always know the if somebody comes in with a infection-like symptoms, we don't always know immediately mm-hmm. what the cause of that infection is in terms of whether it's a virus, a bacteria, or something else. And sometimes we can run a test to try to figure out what might be the cause of that infection. However, the results of that test can take 3 days to obtain. There are cases where we don't have that much time to wait around for 3 days to, mm-hmm. for those results mm-hmm. to come back. So we oftentimes doctors treat immediately, and not wanting to wait for those test results. And there are both pros and cons to that. Obviously, if they do have a bacterial infection, you get faster treatment if you can treat immediately. However, if they don't have a bacterial infection, then you're potentially promoting resistance, and you're treating mm-hmm. someone with a therapy that's not going to help them and could indeed harm them give them a harmful side effect potentially. So another area of research in this domain is the development of diagnostics that could get us information about whether this is a bacteria, whether this is a virus, much, much quicker, and not only tell us what bacteria or what virus it is, but can also test for how responsive that particular infection would be to specific drugs that we might try. So what we're hoping to do, and what we are indeed testing now, are diagnostics that may be able to get us this information perhaps within a couple of hours rather than, mm-hmm. say, 3 days.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Stats and Stories, and today we're talking public health and superbugs with George Washington University's Scott Evans.
So, Scott, let me just follow up on this idea of the diagnostics. So when you're developing these procedures or evaluating these procedures, how do you know they're any good? I mean, there are lots of different criteria on which you'd look at that. So could you just give a quick summary of a couple of the criteria that you use to say if a diagnostic procedure works pretty well?
Yeah, sure. So in general, for diagnostics, some of the basic evaluations would consist of estimating things such as sensitivity and specificity.
So could you just clarify sure. that for sort of a general listener? What do you mean by sensitivity, or what do you mean by specificity?
So sensitivity is the probability of a test being positive for a particular infection when indeed the person is truly infected with that disease, mm-hmm. so has that disease. So it's the probability of the test being positive when you're disease positive. Specificity is the probability of the test being negative when the person is disease negative. And so you would like both sensitivity and specificity to be very high. So that means a sensitivity being very high would mean that as I'm walking into the doc, as a patient is walking into the doctor's office, they want to know that if I'm truly infected, what's the probability the test will actually identify me as infected? Mm-hmm. And that's sensitivity. Or if I'm truly not infected, what's the probability the test will show that I'm not infected? And that's specificity. And I would like those to be very, very high, both of those to be very, very high. Now, on the flip side, so that's what I'm interested when I'm walking into the doctor's office. Now, suppose that I have the test and the test comes back and says, the test indicates that I'm positive for a particular disease. In that particular case, now what I would like to know is, now since the test is positive, I would like to know the probability that I'm truly diseased. Mm-hmm. And so this is what I'm interested in if I'm walking out of the doctor's office, if you might imagine. And this is called predictive value, positive predictive value. Mm-hmm. So a positive predictive value is the probability that I'm truly diseased when now conditional upon the fact that I've had a positive test. Or the negative predictive value is the probability that I'm truly non-diseased, conditional upon now that I've had a test that indicates I'm negative. And in order to calculate both positive and negative predictive value, I need to have an idea about the sensitivity and specificity of the test. And I also need to know the prevalence of the disease. And through surveillance mechanisms, we may have some ideas about what the prevalence is, in which case I could use Bayes' theorem to calculate the positive and negative predictive value of the test.
That's great. That's helpful. Thank you.
I'm imagining some of the challenges that face you in your work. Maybe one of them would be, how do you explain your work to doctors that don't understand statistics in this work? And the other thing would be to journalists. So are there challenges when someone who's a doctor is not sort of trained the way you are?
Yes. And this is really an important aspect of our work, I believe. Mm-hmm. And one of the biggest challenges, I think, for statisticians is how to communicate effectively with, in my case, my clinical colleagues, my doctor colleagues mm-hmm. in particular. So the first element of that is not only getting them to understand me, but for me to understand them. Mm-hmm. And, they help me sort of understand the medical problem at a deeper level and what would be useful for them as they think about how to treat patients and how to diagnose patients. And that helps me, that helps provide me a sort of a foundation or an understanding of what the critical needs are for doctors who are trying to treat mm-hmm. and diagnose patients. And so, one key to that is that, as I'm thinking about statistical concepts and they're thinking about medical concepts, we have to find sort of a common language mm-hmm. and they can't speak too technically for me and I can't speak too technically for them. We want to try to use sort of general language for each other. However, it also requires both on my part and on their part a little bit of learning about, so for me, I have to learn a little bit about the medicine. I have to learn about antibiotics and I have to learn about the different bacteria and the different types of infections mm-hmm. that people can get so that I can understand the problem at a deep level and so that I can communicate with doctors about what I'm thinking and how I describe how we might design or analyze a study or how we interpret the results of a study. And so this is a really important issue. And I think one of the sort of great challenges of our of our profession. So even though I'm not in, you know, a formal classroom, for example, in some ways as a statistician, I'm always teaching or trying to teach people about statistical concepts so that they can understand the results of various studies and communicate with me to help me understand what they're thinking. So, you know, this example of describing sensitivity and specificity and positive and negative predictive value is a good example of that. So it's very important.
In reading up on your career, I came across the piece by GW announcing your taking over as director of the Biostatistics Center. And towards the end of that piece, it mentioned that you felt like there needed to be more interdisciplinary work in this field. And I guess kind of coming off of Richard's question, given the work that you do, when you think about interdisciplinary sort of linkages and work that can sort of broaden our scope of understanding, what are you thinking about in relation to this?
So, I think it, you know, particularly when we think about the superbug infection issue, it is a multidisciplinary effort. Obviously, I interact a lot with medical colleagues who understand these diseases, as you might, you know, as they think about treating patients or diagnosing patients. We have laboratory colleagues, for example, who collect specimens and they run various laboratory tests. We talked about diagnostics, for example. So one of the strategies for evaluating or thinking about diagnostics is we evaluate the genetic profile of the bacteria that we find. And if certain genetic traits are expressed, then what that tends to mean is that that bacteria is going to be resistant to certain types of antibiotics because of the mechanism of which that particular antibiotic works. So one of the ways we think about sort of advancing the field in diagnostics is to get a better understanding of the genetic profile of various bacteria. And so we start interacting with laboratory colleagues, people working on big data problems and looking at the genetics and genomics of both the bacteria, but also of human genetics and human responses that we might see, and how we can use that information to think about new strategies for how to treat or how to diagnose disease.
You know, I'm sorry.
Yep, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, I've really appreciated kind of the light touch that you have in terms of describing, like, randomizing Simon and Garfunkel to treatments as part of one of your one of your papers, and you know, naming the trials. I'm sure you are working really hard to get smart compass, bed frame, door, radar. I mean, there's, you know, I suspect that takes as much work as maybe executing some of these studies. but what I wanted to ask you about was this idea of drug comparison versus therapeutic strategy comparison. I thought that was a really interesting idea. And could you kind of give a quick kind of overview or summary of that?
Sure. This is had a recently published paper. Actually, the print version is just coming out over the next week or so. And so, as I mentioned, when describing the treatment of patients, if a patient comes into the hospital or maybe they're in the ICU, there's really sort of two let me back up a moment. When you're treating patients for a particular disease, whatever affliction they might have, that the decisions about how to treat that patient are – it's not a single decision necessarily. That In many ways, the treatment of patients is dynamic. You make an initial decision about how to treat a patient, but then you see how the patient's doing, and they may be responding well, they may be responding poorly. You get more information about how the patient is doing, and then with that information, you might make an adjustment to treatment. So what happens with patients with infection, there's really sort of two very well-defined treatment decision time points. The first time point is clinicians, infectious disease clinicians, called empiric therapy. That this is the time which I haven't been able to run these laboratory tests yet, so I don't really know what the bacteria is, or whether it's a bacteria, or whether it's a virus, or and if it is a bacteria, what type of bacteria it is, and I don't know the profile about whether I could treat with which drug I could treat it with. So because some patients can't wait, you have to make an initial treatment decision about how to treat them. And one option for that is maybe I don't treat them at all. Maybe I wait for specific information to come. But I may take a laboratory specimen, send it off to the lab, but I may have to wait 3 days for that lab information to come back. So I make an empiric treatment decision when I first see the patient. Then about 3 days later, I get back the laboratory information. And that laboratory information can generally tell me what the offending pathogen is, what bacteria or virus is responsible for this infection, and may also give me information about which drugs might be effective at treating that patient. So instead of studying that second decision time point, they often refer to this as sort of definitive therapy. So we have these sort of two decision time points. Now, typically in clinical trials, and most commonly in clinical trials anyway, we might randomize patients to one of two or more options and then evaluate how effective and safe those options are by following the patients that are randomized into those options and evaluating them. But in this particular case, because there's these two time points that are really critical for decision making, what we've done is basically said, well, let's study strategies of treatments rather than specific treatments. And what I mean by that is, suppose I come in and a doctor doesn't know whether I would be susceptible or resistant to a particular drug, but he has to do something. He has to treat me now. 3 days later, we'll get some more information, but he has to make a decision now. So unfortunately, we're stuck in this situation where you sort of treat today and you diagnose tomorrow. Mm. So they start me out on a particular drug, hoping that might be the right drug. 3 days later, we get back information that tells me from the lab whether they believe that was a good choice or not, whether they believe I'll be susceptible to this drug or whether my infection will be resistant to this drug. And if I'm susceptible, then maybe I stay on that drug and that looks like a good path to follow, and I would go that route. However, if the lab comes back and says, well, it looks like your infection is resistant to this drug, then they would make adjustments and say, well, listen, we have to change you to something else because it looks like you're resistant. Now, so what that means is that I'm studying a strategy of starting out with that drug, but the strategy allows for an adjustment if I get new information that suggests that an adjustment would be wise. And so instead of studying just one drug at a time, I study strategies of treatment that allow for adjustments as new information arises, such as new laboratory information that tells me whether I might be resistant or susceptible. Mm-hmm. Or even just sort of clinical progress, if I seem to be progressing in the right right direction, then maybe you keep me on that therapy. If I'm getting worse, then maybe you make a change and make an adjustment.
Well, Scott, that's all the time we have for this episode of Stats and Stories. Thank you so much for being here.
Well, thank you. It was my pleasure.
Stats and Stories is a partnership between Miami University's Departments of Statistics and Media, Journalism, and Film and the American Statistical Association. You can follow us on Twitter, Apple Podcast, or other places where you can find podcasts. If you'd like to share your thoughts on the program, send your email to statsandstories@miamioh.edu or check us out at statsandstories.net. And be sure to listen for future editions of Stats and Stories, where we discuss the statistics behind the stories and the stories behind the statistics.